Dr. Google can't fix your knee. The Joint Relief Institute can. Fast joint pain relief, covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Amy Guth, in with you for the next hour, talking about all the top business stories on our minds and on our devices. And today we're going to be talking with Robert Chanik from Chicago Tribune. He's the media reporter there, about the top business stories of 2015, both locally and nationally. And it's interesting how quickly we forget and how quickly that news cycle just moves on and we go to the next thing. But as we look through the year, there were some very big stories that are interesting to revisit. We're also going to be talking with Roberto Ferdman from The Washington Post about a story you might have heard a bit about within the shrimp industry, because it seems like a story that wouldn't be on Business Lunch, and yet there's a lot to it. That industry suddenly is kind of fraught with a lot of issues, and there's a lot of stuff going on with that industry that we really need to talk about, because there's some very, very serious issues that have emerged due to a report that has been released. And then we're going to be talking with Danielle Paquette. She's also a reporter at The Washington Post, about why it makes a difference if we buy the men's version or the women's version of something. And that starts at toys, and that keeps on with dry cleaning, with body wash, with razors, with all kinds of stuff. And it's really interesting how sometimes the same product in two different colors can be priced vastly different. So ladies, we're going to need to look at the men's stuff here now, because we might be able to save a few dollars that way. But first, let's talk about co-working. Co-working is a thing that we keep hearing more and more about, and there's several co-working spaces in Chicago, but there's also a brand new one in Springfield. And so we're joined right now by our good friend Scott Traylor. Hi, Scott. How are you?
Hi, Amy. How are you?
Great to hear from you today. Happy Saturday.
Happy, and to you.
Happy day after Christmas. Hope you're staying warm and dry wherever you are and whatever you're doing today.
Dry's tough. It's a little bit wet down here.
Yeah, it is up here too. Well, so you've spent a lot of time, almost 20 years, I think, in my side of the business, right, in the media world. And then you, a few years ago, transitioned to start a media company. But one of the legs of that is the Coterra co-working space that you've started in Springfield. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I was at a PBS station for about 12 years, left there in 2012 to work on my firm full-time, like you said. And I was working out of my house, and all that was great. But there were times where I'd find myself running into town for a meeting, into Springfield, into downtown, and then my next meeting wouldn't be for a few hours later. So I'd either have to sit in a cafe and try to be productive, or come all the way back home, get set up, and then go back into my next meeting. And about that time, I just sort of started learning about the co-working industry and how it's, in addition to providing a collaborative environment, it also provides a flexible office type space. So for X amount of dollars a month, you could have a desk or just use a desk as you needed it in a professional office environment. So with that, I learned a little bit more and eventually launched Coterra. Signed the paperwork back last February, and then finally opened the doors a couple months back.
Excellent. And what is interesting about having it in the space that you're using, it seems like that it's sort of set up for a couple of different purposes. One of them for that startup, that solo entrepreneur, that kind of person, as you were talking about. But then also, you're so close to the State House that there's almost sort of another beat to it, really, that sort of speaks to the lobbyist, the nonprofit world, and that kind of thing.
Right. Some of the lobbyists that would come down, especially some of the advocate lobbyists that don't have huge budgets to work with, would often find themselves working out of a cafe or along the wall at the state capitol near an outlet. So as I started doing a little more research on this, found out that they were exactly the types of people that would come to town occasionally and just need office space occasionally, so where they could actually be productive, get some work done, and at the same time collaborate with others, in the lobbying industry, in that kind of work environment that they can actually get some work done.
Well, it's a really wonderful idea, and I'm super glad that there's a co-working space now in Springfield, because I feel like these are just popping up everywhere. You know, here in Chicago, we have several. One of them is the WeWork space that's not far from here at Tribune Tower. And there's just it's a really interesting environment. I've been in a couple of them, and it's very interesting where you'll see, two desks side by side. One of them is a nonprofit. One of them is, starting a financial business or something. Two totally different things, and yet almost by accident, really interesting serendipity sort of starts occurring and collaboration starts occurring. And it's a really interesting way that I only see getting bigger and bigger, really.
Yeah, it gives people that might otherwise have a chance to cross paths in the business world a chance to do so, and either spark some creativity or spark some productivity or something along those lines, create new opportunities for each other, so that these people that are coming and going, maybe they're in town for a week, for work, but they're not on site at some office full time. It gives them a chance to meet up with other people they might not otherwise have met up with.
That's a really, really interesting idea. And so how does that part work for Coterra? Do you rent the desk, or do you pay by the month, or how does that go?
Really, for us, we're not a large space. We only have about 2,700 square feet, so we don't have dedicated desk at this point. Some of the larger spaces will offer that. So for X amount of dollars, you can have a dedicated desk that you can come and use that's yours, as often as you want. If you still spend half your time working out of the house, you can do that, and then whenever you want to come in, you can do that. For us, we've got probably we can accommodate 25 on the floor at a time. And those are people that can either come in for the day, the week, or the month. And then we also have memberships available, say, for instance, for the lobbyists that are only in town for 6 months at a pop.
Mm-hmm. So it's very, very flexible. You could really do anything from a day at a time to a year at a time, really.
Right, right. And the size and the scope of some of these places is really incredible. I know 1871 up there is huge. They're also an incubator as well, but some of the larger spaces can offer, amenities such as 24/7 access, private office, those sorts of things. So, and it's always good to just, if you're heading to a town, just to get online and Google or look at one of the directories and find a place you can work.
Right, because as you pointed out, it is really kind of a pain to have to not have a home base when you have to run into town, take a meeting, and then you have a few hours. The best you can do is hope to find a spot in a coffee shop where people aren't being too noisy around you, usually is the deal.
Right, and if you're in town and you're bumping into people and you're chit-chatting or, the TV's on or, there's always kinds of distractions. So trying to get, maximum productivity out of your downtime can be tough sometimes.
Yeah, and you mentioned 1871, and I think it's an important distinction to make that the difference between a co-working space and an incubator. And some of them have sort of blurred lines, and I know Coterra has some events on the books, but you're definitely not an incubator. You're there for people to set up and do what they need rather than nurture them. Or help them build their business.
Right, incubators, and I'm not too familiar on that end, but those are places where really you're meant to come in. You might pay a smaller fee for your space, but at the same time you're being mentored. What the whole concept is that you're eventually going to grow and move out and move on to your own space. As a matter of fact, Springfield just opened. We opened our first across the plaza from me at Innovate Springfield, so we're kind of excited to see how that grows. It's part of a collaboration with Lincoln Lake Community College out here. But you're right. It's slightly different from what we offer. We plan on doing some, business events, networking events, seminars, bringing people in to speak, making it educational, but we're in no way a true sort of incubator.
Well, and so tell us a little bit more about those workshops that you have planned. Are you looking for specific topics, or are they going to be kind of recurring themes that people can take advantage of and learn skills from?
Well, probably, we don't have a schedule set as of yet. We'd like to do at least one quarterly, something along the lines of information that's important to solopreneurs and small business owners, entrepreneurs, whether that's using digital technology, marketing, accounting, things like that people that typically, entrepreneurs that get going, they tend to be really good at what they do, whether that's, fixing cars or creating ads or writing or whatever. But at the same time, they don't always have the other sort of, business tools that they need to be a successful, business and grow a company.
Right. And it seems like for entrepreneurs, they have to wear a dozen hats at a time. And so the more skills they can get and not everyone's good at everything, right? Most of us are just good at a few things, but have to learn to do the rest. So it seems like a great thing. But you mentioned this, this incubator that's across the plaza from you. Are we seeing sort of this movement in Springfield right now? Are we about to see some really interesting things coming out of Springfield all of a sudden in the innovation area?
The Innovation Springfield project started 3 or 4 years ago, I think, and they were based out at Lincoln Land. And what they were looking to do is, like a traditional incubator, find people, local business people that want to launch their own firms, and regardless of the field, and get them all together. And they were able to do that, and they found a space in downtown, and they just opened up, I think, in the last month or so. And one of the things that, they're offering is, you know, the barrier to entry is a lot lower than it would be, you know, say, in a larger metropolitan area. So by keeping some of the costs down, they're able to offer some of the things that might otherwise be a little too pricey in some of the incubators in larger cities.
Well, that's interesting. It certainly seems like we're starting to see a lot of, you know, we've had this moment happen in kind of the big, you know, the major metro areas. But it seems like some other areas are starting to sort of make their mark, too, in the innovation space, both with co-working spaces, with a lot of startups, with a lot of nonprofits. And, you know, of course, in Springfield, lobbyists and innovation around that and how that that business model is kind of shifting and people are applying more technology to it. And so I'm excited to see what's happening in Springfield right now, because it seems like a lot of smart people are on the case doing really good work.
Yeah, downtowns, we're starting to come back. We had a, you know, Signet just really briefly on downtown, a significant number of state workers through the years. And then over the last probably decade or so, we probably lost a few thousand of them. But in the meantime, things have been growing. We're adding apartments. You know, that there's been a demand for that, and millennials. You know, we're not, you know, there's about 120,000 people in the city. So we're not, you know, we're not a small town, but, you know, obviously we're not huge. But there's a vibrant urban core that's starting to come back, and Innovate Springfield is, you know, going to be part of that, as well as some of the millennials and whatnot that start moving into some of these new apartments.
Excellent. Well, I can't wait to see everything that's coming out of Springfield. And,
yeah.
And it'll, of course, we'll keep an eye on everything happening at Coterra. Where can people go to find out more about Coterra and getting space or collaborating and that kind of thing?
The website's coterraworks.com. And we're also on Facebook, Facebook/CoterraWorks, and Twitter @CoterraWorks. And what I can do is I can put up some of these, some of this information we talked about on the Coterra blog, which is a link off the Coterra Works website.
Excellent. So everybody, head over there. That's Coterra, C-O-T-E-R-R-A, works.com, CoterraWorks.com. Go there, check it out, ask for Scott Traylor. He's your friend. He'll help you out. He's the man behind all this. Thanks so much for joining us today, Scott.
Thanks a lot, Amy. Stay dry.
All right, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are going to be talking about the top business stories of 2015, both nationwide and right here in Chicago. So stick around. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. WGN. It's the Wintrust Business Lunch. I'm Amy Guth. Thanks for being with us today. Hope you are warm and dry and basking in the glow of the holiday season, wherever you are and whatever you're doing today. Seems kind of quiet out on Michigan Avenue, so I assume everyone is huddled by the fire somewhere with the people they love. All right, my friends, we still have so much to get to here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about a shakeup in the food industry that is very important and has a lot of issues surrounding it, so we need to talk about that. And then also, we're going to be talking about the difference in buying men's products versus women's products, because there are some surprising cost differences for some of the same things that come in different colors. So we got to talk about that. But first, very, very importantly, we are joined by our good friend Robert Chanik. He's the media reporter at Chicago Tribune. You can read everything he does at chicagotribune.com and, of course, in the print edition. And we're here today to talk about all of the big stories from 2015, because there are so many. It was a big year in the business world. Hi, Robert. How are you?
Good. How you doing, Amy?
Good. Good to hear from you on this kind of dreary Saturday. Hope you're staying dry and warm. So,
yeah.
Much
after Christmas sale day.
That's
much
right.
Holiday.
That's right. It's a big day for a lot of people. So, let's start with the national stories that had our attention this year, because there are so many, both locally and nationally. But I want to talk about the national ones first. You know, the one that I think is still going, really, that's such a big and incredible story, is the one the pharma bro,
Martin Shkreli.
That guy. He every time we kind of forget about him, he does something else and pops back up, even just recently.
It's a fascinating story. As people, I'm sure, remember, he was sort of the poster child for pharmaceutical/corporate greed when he raised the price of Daraprim by, I think it was 5,000% back in August.
Right, which is literally a life-saving drug for so many people.
Absolutely. I think it's the only, or certainly the leading treatment for toxoplasmosis and people with compromised immune systems, that can be a life or death kind of scenario. So, yeah, he raised the price from, I don't know what it was, $13 or something to $750, I believe.
Which is out of reach for most of us, I think.
For a pill or whatever. Right. Yeah.
$750 a pill. Yeah. We talked about that on this show, right? Because even in a Brazilian market, that same pill for Daraprim was about 2 cents a pill. So it was really interesting just to see, you know, how far this had reached. And this was just unchecked corporate greed. And now he's back in the headlines, back in the legal trouble that we kind of all saw coming.
He was arrested a couple, I think it was a week ago or 2 weeks ago, it all kind of a blur now, but for securities fraud charges, and it was related to a previous management of a hedge fund and another pharmaceutical company, and forced, you know, they had to do the perp walk and was forced to resign as Turing CEO, and he resigned as a CEO of another pharmaceutical company that they had acquired, and now he's basically at home in his room, released on a very steep bond. And a lot of people, I don't know if you know, there's a live YouTube stream where he's still keeping himself in the spotlight.
I didn't know that.
It's captured a few of my colleagues' attention during their idle moments. He sits in front of the screen and plays chess and talks to his fans and waits for the next shoe to drop, I guess.
How interesting. Okay, we've all got to go to YouTube and check that out. CEOs were that we heard from this year, that certainly was the CEO apologizing for the Chipotle issues, because there was, we thought, you know, one small problem, there was an apology, and then it became a much bigger problem, another apology, and now it seems like it's really not looking good for Chipotle.
No, it's still unfolding. I mean, I know there was another recent outbreak. I don't have the details in front of me, but there was a big E. coli outbreak. 9 states, 52 customers were affected, including Illinois. Then there was this one horrible, 140 people got sick at a Boston restaurant from a different kind of outbreak. All this is happening within a month of each other, basically, this fall. And yeah, they've apologized. The CEO, Steve Ells, took out a full page ad in the Tribune and 60 other newspapers to say we're sorry and that they're instituting better food safety measures. If I remember correctly, I mean, I read, you know, a quick list of what they're going to do to improve things. That's still a couple weeks away before those measures are implemented. So it's people are still a little nervous about eating at Chipotle.
Right. Well, and, you know, it calls to mind the Taco Bell thing a few years ago, and it took them, I think, 5 quarters to recover after their, you know, after the sort of the specter of not healthful food was upon them. It took them a while to shake that.
For sure. I think, you can't look at a restaurant and not have that in your head after all these stories. It's, you know, something, there's probably risks associated with plenty of fast food restaurants, but when you get hit that hard, that quickly, and, you know, that widespread, it's a tough thing to recover from, sure.
Yeah, and I think especially for Chipotle, who really pushed this, you know, you build it yourself, it's healthier, we're so into sustainable food and free-range chicken and all that, suddenly for that specter to be over them, I think it will be a little bit difficult for them to recover, but hopefully they will be able to do so. But you know what, that was not the only fast food that was in the news. Also, I had kind of forgotten that earlier this year we heard so much about McDonald's, and there was just such a shakeup there, and the breakfast all day thing, and it seems like they're kind of turning over a new leaf, or at least trying to.
They have made progress this year, there's no question. And in fact, the breakfast all day thing, a lot of people are looking at that as sort of maybe the tipping point to getting, as I said in the story, their mojo back. I mean, it's been successful. They had profits in the third quarter, or sales rise, I should say, in the third quarter for the first time in 2 years. And you know, that was at the beginning of the all-day breakfast initiative. So I think that definitely resonated. And new CEO Steve Easterbrook, who was a longtime McDonald's guy, he's simplifying the menu, which I think is probably an important part of the plan. And in addition, they're selling some of the franchise restaurants back to outside investors. I think that they're the company restaurants, I should say, to franchisees. They're just looking to get back to basics and try to figure out a way to get McDonald's moving in the right direction. And there are signs that that's happened, that this year they're starting to turn the corner and making some strides.
Yeah, and, you know, we're about out of time, but another story I definitely want to touch on that is about the most Chicagoish story that ever Chicago to Chicago was the Michael Jordan and the supermarket ad, because that really touched on a lot of different players in the Chicago space.
It did, yeah. He basically, in 2009, the quickest version of it, there was a commemorative issue honoring Michael Jordan's induction into the Basketball Hall of Fame, and Jewel and Dominick's, which were then both, you know, competing supermarkets, as we all remember, took out ads and invoked Michael Jordan in their ads to celebrate. And Michael Jordan felt that they were using his likeness without permission, sued them, and won an $8.9 million federal jury verdict against Dominick's, which, of course, is now out of business. And interestingly enough, is owned by the same owner as Jewel's, Cerberus Capital. So basically, that was, you know, he was suing this one hedge fund, if you will, investment firm, for these wrongs that happened, what are we now, 6 years ago.
Right.
And they ended up settling on both counts. And Jordan said he wasn't really after the money. He was just trying to protect his name. And he donated the proceeds, everything, you know, beyond attorney's fees, to 23 Chicago area charities. So made good on his promise and prevailed.
He often did
in his playing days.
Right. Yeah. And of course, it was 23 charities. Of course, number 23 rides again. All right.
You got it. Yeah.
All right. Robert Chanek, thanks so much for being with us. You can read both of these stories, both the local and the national top business stories of 2015 at chicagotribune.com. Lots of wonderful information in there to remind us of all the stuff that has happened in this space, both in Chicago and nationally. Thanks so much for being with us, Robert. Have a great day.
You too. Thanks, Amy.
All right. All right, my friends, we're going to take a little break and then get you to news. And when we come back, we're talking about a little bit more stuff that's going on in the food industry and in the retail industry. We're going to be talking all about that on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch with you till 1 o'clock. We are talking about all kinds of big stories in the tech world and in the business world. And there is a story that I know has been all over my social media feeds, and I'm sure you have seen this too. We're joined right now by Danielle Paquette. She is a reporter at the Washington Post. And there is a story at WashingtonPost.com that you should all go see if you have not already seen it on social media, because it is a very interesting one. And that is about why on earth it could possibly be the case that products that seem very innocuous, like razors and soap and body wash and things like that, costs way less if you buy the men's version versus the women's version. Welcome to the show, Danielle.
Hey, happy to be here.
So tell us about this. And I mean, I know it's been all over social media. It's been a lot of people are talking about this. But really, let's kind of get down to the nitty gritty of it. It kind of started with this like a scooter, almost like a toy, that really was essentially the same thing in two different colors. One was the generic for any child one, and then one was the girl specific one that was pink and had sparkles. And it had a significant, almost double the price difference.
Right. I think that really struck a chord with people, because we've noticed some of these price differences before just wandering down the aisle. That particular scooter, They weighed, that model at least, they weighed the same amount. They were made with the same materials. The only difference, as you noted, one was pink, one was red. Well, the red one was $24.99. The pink one was $49.99. Researchers in New York recently just went through 800 products with male or female versions. All that means is that they're identical except for maybe gender-specific packaging. That could be the color. That could be anything indicating for male or female. What they found is that, controlling for quality, the items marketed to girls and women cost an average of 7% more than similar products aimed at boys and men.
Well, I don't like that report very much at all.
Right. And it's hard to explain the people who studied this phenomenon. It's not just in New York. It's in California. It's in Florida. These retailers sell to everyone across the country. They all wonder, well, why? Retailers, some economists believe, think women are just a little more likely to spend more money on something, which, you know, we might read as sexist or just wrong. But some other researchers are saying, well, when people think about a man's product, they think that that's just the original version, mm-hmm. but that a woman's product might be the specialty version, and we're more willing to pay more for something we think is personally tailored. So it could be psychological.
Right. You know, after this, I first saw this story, I was thinking about it and trying to think of an example where the men's product was the special or the different one. And the only one I came up with, there was Nivea lotion, and there was like a one mm-hmm. Nivea men, where as opposed to the mm-hmm. regular Nivea. And then I think there was it was like Vaseline lotion. There was two different kinds of lotion that had a specific one targeted to men, but with the implication being that the regular long-standing version of it was the unisex and or the women's.
Right. And oftentimes, the men's in that case might have been seen as more specialty if the women's lotion would have come out first. But when we were looking through the samples, we saw, you know, a chic hydro silk razor cartridge, the silk, the purple package, that's $18.49. The identical chic razor package for men, the Hydro 5, is $14.99. And so I've been telling my friends who've shared this information across social media, why not always buy the men's razors?
Yeah, really. And I think they're really kind of a better quality. I've been thinking this about men's razors for years, because it seems like for women, we have a little more real estate to cover with our razors, but the razors don't seem like they're as high quality, and they always cost so much more than the men's version of it.
Right. I always feel a little bit better after the men's shave, I might say. So
I know.
That's interesting. It's a double whammy.
Well, and so it also brings up the idea of dry cleaning, because, a lot of times you'll see in the window of a dry cleaner, you know, men's shirts, $1.99, same day service, something like that. But if you bring in just a plain button up shirt that's, you know, if you bring in a women's version of that shirt, it's going to be $5 or $6 to dry clean it. And surely just the little, you know, the darts on the side that make it a little fitted surely can't be that difficult for a dry cleaner. So I've long wondered about this. So this has been a story that I really cannot get enough of, watching this and thinking about this thing, because it's, you know, as you said, it's probably not an intentional layer of sexism, but more of an opportunity within the retail world to get more money out of consumers, really.
Yeah, and some states have actually enacted laws to combat this kind of insidious form of discrimination. What you describe, services for women being pricier for them than services for men, is actually outlawed in California, New York, in Miami-Dade County, and Florida. In these areas, a dry cleaner cannot charge a man or a woman more based on gender. They must adjust the price based on labor intensity. So maybe a shirt with ruffles might cost a little more than just a plain shirt, but it doesn't matter if it's a man or a woman bringing it in. But as far as I know, that's the only places in the country policing this kind of behavior. But when it goes, that's for services. When it comes to products, there's absolutely no law that would stop a retailer from selling the pink version a little bit more expensive than the blue version. Mm-hmm. So researchers that I talk to are saying, hey, all you can really do is raise awareness for the consumer. Maybe tweet, maybe use the hashtag gender pricing whenever you see an item like this or a price disparity in the aisle of a Target.
That's an excellent idea. So let's all go do that with hashtag gender pricing. Let's call it out when we see it. You also mentioned in the story on WashingtonPost.com about Ian Ayers, who's did this independent analysis. He's an economist who went around. And he teaches at, you know, Yale Law School, and he on his own went and checked out car dealerships across Chicago. And this is very interesting, because I have had a very similar experience. And I think a lot of women have kind of faced some degree of sexism, or, hey, are you waiting for your husband, when you're like, well, I was actually going to buy a car, but now I'm just going to leave because I don't really appreciate what you just said. But his analysis, he sent men and women to car dealerships across Chicago and learned it went more than just male and female. Their race factored in as well.
Yeah, so that study came out in 1991, and it was considered a landmark, this mm-hmm. kind of gender bias, race bias. Across the board, white men tended to get the best deal. But yeah, like you noted, when it came to women, maybe they assumed the women knew less about the prices, or maybe they assumed a minority might know less about the standard price. They would jack it up. Yeah, the women found a 40% markup when they were shopping. And that was just fascinating. After Ian did that study, he looked at McDonald's Happy Meal toys to see if girls and boys could request a gender change in different states. It was fascinating.
And what was the finding of the Happy Meal toys?
shows. What he found was that some McDonald's wouldn't give the girls and boys the toy they requested. They would give the girl toy to the girls and the boy toy to the boys. So he actually called those McDonald's out in a follow-up study and kind of changed the way that happened in the fast food world. Now kids can get the toy that they request.
Very, very interesting. Well, I'm so glad that you're taking a look at this topic. Keep it up, because I think there's a long way to go here in this area. We're going to follow along on WashingtonPost.com. So, well, thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate
you
taking time out of your Saturday. Everybody, go to WashingtonPost.com. Danielle Paquette's story and many other stories of hers are right there on WashingtonPost.com, and you can read all about them. Thanks, Danielle. Have a great Saturday.
Thank you. You too.
All right. Okay. Well, that's I love her idea for the hashtag. So let's all do that. Let's look next time we're buying products. Let's just look at the difference between the men's price and the women's price and just see where things are fallen. Because you know what? No one should be charged extra for extra that didn't cost extra to make. We should all just, if it's the same product but different packaging, let's all pay the same. So let's call that out and be on top of that. Let's use that hashtag gender pricing and just see what happens, see what change we can make. All right. We're going to take a little break and we can. When we come back, we're talking with another reporter from the Washington Post all about a crisis in the food industry that is very important, and you need to hear all about it here on 720 WGN. It's Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. I hope you are warm and dry and cozy on this kind of dreary and soggy day after Christmas. But I hope you are with people that you love and doing as you please today. All right. So as we wrap things up and this last bit of time we have here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, we know there is this time of year. We're talking a lot about food. There's a lot of stuff going on, and I know we all want to do the right thing, but sometimes it's about convenience and we grab what's available, and sometimes it's hard to know what food is good. I know we think a lot about the local, the organic, the healthy, that kind of thing, but sometimes we don't necessarily think about some of the bigger ethical issues that are behind the foods that we eat. And so there was a recent scandal that's kind of the resurgence of a scandal a couple of years ago that has happened in the specific to the shrimp industry. And it's a very important issue because it is just fraught with some really, really serious issues. And it's looking very likely, frankly, that if you had some of that shrimp dip or some cocktail shrimp or something like that over this holiday, you probably inadvertently supported companies that are maybe not up to snuff on the human rights issues. So joining us right now from WashingtonPost.com is a friend of this show, Roberto Ferdman. Hi, Roberto. Welcome.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you back. Well, so talk to us about this story, because we see shrimp in a headline and we think it's probably a recipe. But in fact, this story is really quite heavy. There's a lot going on with this. So sort of talk us through.
So the latest wrinkle in an issue that we can talk about more broadly is that in Thailand, the Associated Press, which has been investigating this issue for over a year now, found that there were called peeling sheds. And now peeling sheds are related to the ready-to-cook shellfish, the ready-to-cook shrimp that we know very well in the United States. It's very popular. It's often sold frozen. And you can essentially dump it from these bags straight onto a skillet. It's convenient, which, you know, a word we love within the food world here. The problem is that convenience comes at a huge cost. And the cost is the peeling, which needs to be done by hand. It is very labor intensive. And in Thailand, where the Associated Press found not just that the industry is complicit, but even the government in many instances has been complicit, there are many companies that are using these peeling sheds, which are essentially unregulated, to forcibly house mostly migrants who are underpaid, paid non-living wages to peel these shrimp. So it's essentially a form of modern day slavery that we all support when we buy shrimp in the United States. And when I say we all support when we buy shrimp in the United States, it's because part of what the Associated Press found in this investigation is that this shrimp has infiltrated virtually every single grocery store in the U.S., which is a pretty scary thought for people trying to support practices that they consider laudable or that they want to support.
Definitely. So there was an investigation that started right after a 2013 report. And that investigation was by the Environmental Justice Foundation. So they're a non-governmental, independent organization. And they start trying to chronicle the abuses and the human rights violations going on in this in the Thai shrimp industry. And that seems like it was such a big step in this. But then there was another, you know, as you noted, the AP report that just came out recently followed up on some of the things that were unearthed in 2013 that really not much progress has been made. So essentially, a lot of people have known about this and have not done much to stop it, really, or to improve conditions.
What's incredible about this problem is that it extends to many different facets of the shrimp industry in Southeast Asia. So in 2013, The Guardian conducted its own investigation where it found kind of rampant labor abuses in the fishing aspect of the shrimp industry. Essentially, they would convince migrants to go out to sea and then take them much further out than they had anticipated and essentially lock them on a boat where they would fish for months as opposed to the weeks or even days they had been promised. And this was kind of an eye-opening report, but this was, as you said, almost 3 years ago. And the practices have only become clear that the practices extend well beyond the fishing aspect, in this case, the peeling, as both the report you indicated and the most recent report by the Associated Press showed. The good news is that in the aftermath of the Associated Press report, the largest exporter of shrimp in Thailand, which essentially collects shrimp from most of the companies producing it in Thailand. Thailand is one of the largest producers of shrimp in the world, and it exports half of the shrimp it produces to the U.S., we essentially only eat exported shrimp, or imported shrimp. About 90% of the shrimp eaten in the United States is imported. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the CEO of this company pledged to spend millions of dollars to fix this problem. It's unclear whether that's actually going to fix the problem, or it's just words being put forth in the aftermath of this incriminating report. But it's encouraging that it was enough of a scandal to force him to speak publicly about addressing the problem.
Definitely. And it seems like some major U.S. and U.K. brands have stepped in and said, enough. So Walmart said that it would be actively engaged in the issue. Costco said it's going to be telling its suppliers to take corrective action. And then Tesco, which is the big supermarket chain in Britain, has said this is completely unacceptable. So for now, is the best move for a consumer who wants to, do the right thing and not support any kind of, human rights issues, are we looking at the best course of action right now being more of a boycott of shrimp, or is it just really, really careful, research to buy U.S. shrimp, or what's a consumer to do right now?
Well, part of what's so insidious about this problem is that it's making its way to pretty much every single grocer, and grocers that have gone out of their way to try to prevent this sort of product from coming in. Whole Foods is actually a perfect example. Whole Foods said that they were being told that none of the shrimp coming in was linked to any of these problems, and yet their suppliers said they couldn't account for the source or the origin of all of their shrimp. So really the problem is beyond these grocers. The way, which is not to say that they aren't working to fix this and fix this sort of ambiguity that happens in between. The best way to avoid this problem is to be very conscious of labels and figure out where your shrimp is coming from. Ideally, at this moment, it's not coming from Southeast Asia, where it might be mixed with shrimp that's tied to some form of modern-day slavery, or to buy local shrimp, which might come at a higher price, and it might be harder to find because so little of the shrimp that we eat here is harvested domestically.
True, true. Well, but, if enough people start buying local, shrimp they know they can trust, I think that applies to any kind of food, right? That price will eventually go down and it'll be a little bit more manageable because we vote with our dollars and we speak with them too. So it's a very fraught issue, but I'm very, very glad that you have shed light on this, because I think so many people, we want to do the right thing, but it's very hard to do the research and it's very hard to know all of these steps in the supply chain for our food. So I appreciate the work that you're doing, and thanks for bringing this story to our attention. Everybody go to WashingtonPost.com and read this story, because there's a lot of really wonderful information in the story and really a lot of great backstory. So Roberto Ferdman, thanks so much for joining us today on the Wintrust Business Lunch.